Welcome to Givers, Doers, and Thinkers. Today we talk to True Charity founder James Whitford about what authentic, effective charity looks like and what it doesn't look like. Let's go. Givers, Doers, and Thinkers introduces listeners to the fascinating people and important ideas at the heart of American civil society. We speak with philanthropists, reformers, social entrepreneurs, nonprofit executives, religious leaders, scholars, journalists, and anyone else who will help us understand contemporary civil society's achievements and failures. My name is Jeremy Beer. Thank you for joining us. Okay, welcome to another episode of Givers, Doers, and Thinkers. I am coming to you from sunny Phoenix, Arizona on August 17th, 2022. And I am pleased to have as my guest, James Whitford, the founder and CEO of True Charity. We'll be talking to James about what the characteristics of genuine charity are, about poverty and those living in poverty, about effective solutions, and about what his organization is doing to help advance True Charity. James Whitford received his doctorate from the University of Kansas Medical Center and practiced physical therapy and wound care before he and his wife, Marcia, founded Watered Gardens Ministries in Joplin, Missouri in 2000. So as you can see, we are dealing with a true doer here today on this podcast. In 2012, James founded the True Charity Initiative to advance nationally the cause of privately funded effective charity at the most local level. His work has appeared in Heritage Foundation's Index of Culture and Opportunity, Patrick Henry College's Newsmaker Series, World Magazine, The Christian Post, and The Hill. He and Marcia were honored to receive the World News Group Hope Award on behalf of Watered Gardens Ministries in Washington, D.C. in 2019. James Whitford, welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy. Great to be with you today.
It's our honor to have you with us. My own inclinations always take me toward thinkers for interview guests on this podcast, because that's the world I come out of, and I'm a terrible doer. So it's good to have a real doer here, who has worked on the ground and in the trenches to deal with some of the most sort of, you know, difficult problems that our country is dealing with, or that people, individuals are dealing with. Perhaps we could start with you just sort of telling your story, how you got started in this line of work. I understand that you had a heart for the poor in Joplin, Missouri, and started something that wasn't going in the direction in the end, maybe that you really wanted things to go.
Right. Yes. Well, it was out of compassion for people and our faith that caused my wife and I, Marcia and I, to start this ministry called Watered Gardens. It was just a small little redistribution center, really, for a lack of a better term. People would donate things, and we, out of compassion, would hand things out to people who came in and said they needed help. And we realized not too far down the road from the start of our ministry that our good intentions weren't leading to the outcomes that we really hoped to see in people's lives, and realized that we needed to change some things that we were doing. And so began to rethink charity work and how we could do it more effectively. So that, you know, that's today, of course, the ministry's grown in our city of in Southwest Missouri in Joplin, and includes a lot of different things that we're doing in the way of helping folks who are struggling in chronic poverty and homelessness and all of the things that are connected with that, Jeremy, you know, as far as addiction issues and pasts that are full of neglect and abuse and trauma and all of that. So that's all a part of that. But
talk about that just a little bit more. Like, who is coming when you were starting this ministry, and what did you see that caused you to think, we're not helping here like we thought we would be?
Yeah. Well, we saw the same people over and over and over and over again. And so that's one sign that you're not actually resolving poverty. That was certainly the main thing. I mean, you know, when you get into something like this, compassion wants to see fruit. And so we just weren't seeing that. And that's really why we decided we needed to change our model, how we were practicing charity.
But what was the change then? What were the aha moments for you?
Sure. Well, like one of the things that we realized is I read a book by Robert Lupton called Toxic Charity. And in it, he steps out five steps to dependency. He says, if you give something to somebody once, they'll appreciate it. If you give the same thing to that person again, they'll anticipate that you'll do it a third time. If you give it a third time, they'll develop an expectation that you'll do it a fourth. And if you give it a fourth time, they're going to feel entitled, and a fifth time dependent. And so it's appreciation, anticipation, expectation, entitlement, and dependency. And so we saw that and thought, gosh, we've got to get away from that. Well, the only way to get away from that when you're dealing with relief type needs, let's say food, shelter, and clothing, which I mean, in these days are being touted as, you know, human rights, which they're not, but they are basic needs. Everybody needs food, shelter, and clothing. But how can you help people who have those needs without marching them into a dependent pattern of living? So that was the problem to solve. And the way that we did that is we just kind of became a work first mission. An earn it model is sometimes what people will say. And so even if you need a meal for the night, well, there's certainly a way that you could earn a voucher for that meal so that you could have the voucher in your pocket ahead of time, walk into the dining hall and turn in your voucher for a meal that you earned. And so it can work like that with food, clothing, shelter, other basic items that people need. And what we found is that a better way of doing charity is to look at every person as having capacity, potential, and ability, rather than getting over-focused on the hurdles, the dysfunction, or the incapacity. It's not that we should ignore those things, but every person's got something that they can do. And it's so important that we're reminding people there's an inherent worth and dignity in every person that's most visibly expressed through work, through effort. And so so we started what we call a worth shop. It's one of our ministries in Joplin. So we call it a worth shop because we know work awakens worth in people's lives. And so now, no matter what it is, folks are crafting goods that go to market, or they're helping in our Redeemed Bean coffee business. They're recycling leather products into journals. So there's just different kinds of little social enterprises that we have where people can sit down and be a part of something that's productive and be a contributor. And we found that people, they love it. I mean,
yeah, you talked about, I think on your website, like some people don't, but most people do. Is that right? Like there is a little bit of filtering that happens when you introduce this kind of concept, is that right?
Absolutely. So it depends on the level of entrenchment of an entitlement mentality, like how dependent is a person on, you know, systems to feed, shelter, and clothe them. And so it can be really hard to help a person out of that. It requires relationship, inspiration, encouragement, but also the opportunity to work. But there are a lot of people who... Once they earn that they need, they realize it's so much better than being just on the receiving end of someone's good intentions or on the receiving end of benevolence. So they enter into partnership. So it's not an us and them any longer. And a lot of people have had great feedback, great comments for us about, I walked outside the shelter one night. We have a couple of different shelters, but this was the adult men's shelter, and walked out one evening and a guy stopped me and he said, hey, I've been to missions all over the nation, but I've never been to one where I had to work for my bed and my meals. You guys take the shame out of the game. I mean, and another guy standing beside him said, yeah, it's like we get to keep our dignity. So people, they really recognize the value of work. Not everyone, but there are many who do.
And you point out too, I think maybe you can talk about this a little bit more. We don't want to give people the wrong idea that you're not putting people into sweatshops where they get paid, you know, $3 an hour to earn. I mean, you point out the ratio of reward to how much time has worked is very, very high.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We're certainly liberal in that. And so the rate of exchange is favorable to the client or the guest who's with us. Absolutely.
It's a principle you're trying to protect, not the, you're not making, you know, cheap Nikes.
That's right. It's a principle. It's a principle, but it's also kind of a kickstart toward work. So a majority of people in our shelter who come in unemployed leave with a with gainful employment. And we think part of that has to do with the fact that we're embracing work on the front end. I mean, we know that research says the working poor are happier than the welfare poor. So there's something about being involved in a schedule on a day-to-day basis, having some responsibility, working alongside other people that actually does something for the mind and soul of man. And so we think that leads to greater, better outcomes.
Yeah. Well, let's linger on this actually, so that we talk about what exactly is happening. So talk about the social enterprises. You kind of just went over quickly there and tell us what's involved with that. How does that work? How do people get involved and what's expected of them? And then how gainful employment happens on the other end, whether those things are connected or not.
Yeah, well, it's a combination of a lot of things that happen. Everything from, I mean, you know, doing good interviews, making sure that we have our volunteer teams trained to sit down with individuals to understand what's going on. You know, every single person is different. You know, I love Arthur Brooks's discussion on complicated and complex. He says, complicated problems like building a jet engine. But once you figured out, you've got a blueprint. Now you can build as many jet engines as you want. It's a complicated problem to solve. But complex is more like a football game. No matter your tools that you have for predicting a football game, you never know exactly how it's going to go because it's too complex. Well, individuals are like this. Poverty is like this. It's too complex to have a blueprint solution. So I think it's very important for our volunteer teams to be able to sit down one-on-one with people, get to know what's going on, and be able to help do mental health screenings. We've got a team that's beginning physical health screenings with every person. So it's got to be a holistic approach. But then, yeah, the next day after they come into shelter, and of course, if we're just talking about one of our shelter ministries, the next day, they're going to go down to the Worth Shop and they're going to get involved there. Now we, you know, buy large hides of leather and they can get involved in cutting, staining, sewing leather journals together. They're beautiful handmade journals. That's one of the things that we do. We take copper out of air conditioner condenser units. That's rough copper tubes that are then cleaned and flattened and put through a roller and can be stamped, personalized with somebody's name and even embedded into one of those leather journals or embedded into a leather cuff that a person could wear as a wrist around the wrist. And so that's another one of the things that we do. We have a coffee roaster. We do redeemed bean coffee. So some of the students in our long-term program get trained in how to do that, and we'll be serving in that capacity. So those are just a few of the things that we do.
Did you stand up these businesses yourself?
We did. They're all actually out of one building, but yes, we're always looking for things that allow for creativity to be expressed if possible. And then things that, you know, have a wide reach as far as a target in the market. And so these are the things that we've decided to pursue for right now.
That's great. And then how does the employment work? Do you have business partners who consider your people for employment? How does it all work? And how do you stand up?
Yeah, you bet. So those meetings where volunteers are sitting down, we call them care coordinators. So there are going to be goals that are being established with clients and guests that they own those goals. And of course, for us, work is incredibly important. Employment's the only way out of poverty. I mean, a job is the way out. And so I want to make sure we're helping people get to work. And we have a job training program inside of our mission called Jobs for Life, where mentors connect with individuals and they go through education and gain those essential skills. Some people call them soft skills, getting ready to go to work. For those who have maybe tougher issues, Jeremy, that they may be candidates for our long-term program. We've got a year and a half long-term residential program where there's a lot of education, and work readiness and physical wellness that all go into preparing a person to work. And then we've developed relationships with employers in our community who just love the mission and want to be a part of the continuum for people to make it off the streets. And, you know, our long-term goals for those folks, our metrics would be independently insured, independently housed, full-time employed. So those are a few things that we want to see for folks coming out of that long-term program.
I'm sure the answer is you don't seek government funding, but do you have the attention of governmental agencies around you? And what's the relationship there, if any?
Yeah. So, I mean, we have a lot of relationships with organizations and agencies in our community. We really do believe in the principle of subsidiarity. This idea that, you know, neighbors should be helping neighbor before the state helps your neighbor. And there are layers, of course, of that concentric type thinking. And we really work hard to adhere to that. So it's not that there may be somebody that's seeking disability, you know, from the Social Security Administration. Maybe they really need that, but maybe there's some other ways to get help for that person before they, you know, become dependent on a very small monthly check for the rest of their lives. And so we want to just make sure we're thinking about, hey, do you have family and friends? Let's talk with them first. And well, first of all, it's what can you do for yourself? And then family and friends. Are there church? Is there a church you're involved with? And so we just kind of work those concentric circles. But we certainly have relationships with both privately funded and publicly funded organizations in our city. We of course, are principally privately funded.
I like talking to you because you're in this sort of like circumscribed area of Joplin, Missouri. This isn't New York City or something. It's sort of like a comprehensible regenerate area. Yeah. But there are other agencies and organizations, charities that are probably operating on a somewhat different model, maybe more, a little bit more of a welfare model. I'm not saying that pejoratively, but just factually. What do they think about what you're doing?
Well, we've been pretty successful at influencing our community. And that really was the birth of the True Charity Initiative. And just this, and I mean, maybe.
It's a great segue, James. Now I'm giving you an on-ramp to talking about the True Charity Initiative.
Well, it evolved naturally out of when we made the changes in Watered Gardens Ministries to be more developmental, more challenging than handout. What we found were there were a lot of people who just no longer came to visit us. I mean, they were going to go somewhere else for whatever was easiest to get for that day or whatever the need was for the day, which I understand, but it doesn't help them out of poverty. And so we realized we've got to do more than influence the culture within the four walls of our ministry. We've got to influence the culture of the community and began doing some lunch and learn education for leaders in our community to think through principles of effective charity, and then also did public service announcements through radio and television, billboards. And so we've done a lot in our community to help sway opinion. That doesn't mean that there aren't charities out there who may be a little bit more welfare oriented or handout oriented, but we have, a good movement happening in our community toward effective charity. Because we've really focused so much on influencing our community, other communities began to hear about that and said, hey, could you come and talk with our leadership? And that's when the True Charity Initiative began to, you know, be a national movement.
Yeah, so talk about that. How does it work?
The True Charity Initiative is all about effective charity at the most local level. And so it is this idea of subsidiarity. In fact, you know, our vision for the future would be to see this principle of subsidiarity practiced as the norm nationwide. We really want to see that idea employed. And the way that we're doing that right now is we engage a lot of leaders. So over the last year, nearly 700 leaders in a dozen cities through workshops and seminars. We've got a national conference that we hold. And so these leaders will come and learn about seven marks of effective charity and, you know, these ideas of subsidiarity and other things and how to put them into practice. And so what we find is that 9 out of 10 of these folks will leave our educational events and with an intent to change the way that they're practicing charity, which is great. But we know that talk is cheap. Real change is tough. And so we've developed tools and training that can really help leaders employ these ideas. For example, I mean, you and I have been talking about our worth shop. Well, you know, we call it an earn it model. We developed a model action plan that is kind of the worth shop put in generic terms, but it gives you enough meat to actually be able to take some of these things and put them into play in your own community. In fact, some of the very social enterprises you and I were talking about, we've stepped that out in process and procedure so that people can do that in their own communities. And in fact, one of the communities we've done some work in Huntsville, Alabama, they've taken our model action plan, Earn Earn It model. They're going to put one in their city and they're calling it a reciprocity center. Well, so this is good. So now the organizations that can't necessarily give birth and develop a worth shop, they'll at least know there's a reciprocity center in the city where they can send someone to earn whatever it is that they were about to give them instead of just feeling like they've got to give a handout. So there's going to be that alternative. But model action plans like that, how to take your Christmas giveaway time and turn it into a Christmas market where there's reciprocity or exchange involved. So we have a mentorship model action plan, how to develop a mentorship program. We've had organizations that had no program to really help develop relationships between people, which is so key if you're really going to help people out of poverty. And they've taken that model action plan and put it into play. So now there are mentorship programs, you know, in different areas around the nation from the tools that we're developing. So a big one, Jeremy, is outcome. We have an outcomes toolkit. That's a tough one for folks who have not learned how to, you know, develop key performance indicators and that type of thing. Well, we've got a whole toolkit of videos and guides and things that will help any leader in an organization, a nonprofit, develop outcomes with key performance indicators. And that's so important if we're really going to ensure that we're working towards successful models. So those are just some of the things that we have that we're helping organizations learn to.
Yeah, it's incredible. It sparks many more questions from me. I'll ask those questions when we come back from this break, and we'll be right back talking with James Whitford, founder and CEO of True Charity. As the education sector in the United States continues to evolve rapidly, some questions about the future of private Christian colleges and universities are in order. How will these institutions survive? How should they respond to the changing educational climate? And will they continue to serve the purpose of educating the whole person, both academically and spiritually? On this November 28th webinar, John Hanna, director of the Center for Civil Society, we'll be joined by Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine University School of Public Policy, and David Beer, Director of the Center for Christian Faith and Culture at Malone University, for a frank and illuminating discussion of these questions. Register for the webinar at centerforcivilsociety.org/events. And if you miss it, you can find all our Givers, Doers, and Thinkers webinars on the Center for Civil Society's YouTube channel. Link in podcast description. All right, we are back and very honored and pleased to have as our guest today James Whitford, a founder and CEO of True Charity. And we've been talking about all the ways in which James and his team are building, are sort of exporting the model so that they built in Joplin, Missouri, to other communities around the country. And we're just talking about outcomes and KPIs, as we call it in the business world, key performance indicators, because it's important to know how you're doing. Are you having success, right, with these programs, these models? Are there certain KPIs that are the same across communities and are the most important ones for people to be thinking about?
Well, I think the KPIs vary quite a bit, but there are certainly common outcome domains that are there. In fact, we, in our outcome toolkit, we have an exhaustive list of outcome domains that are going to be pretty common across nonprofits who are working in this field of, you know, fighting poverty. But certainly we're looking at things like social capital. Are we helping build social capital?
How do you measure social capital?
We actually developed a social capital survey. We went ahead and developed a 10-question questionnaire for individuals that helps us gauge where they are in, I guess we would say, relational health. And so you can do pre and post or along the way, just to look for changes in social capital over time. And there are other ways to measure social capital too, and just relationships that you're helping form within a nonprofit and tracking those. But that's an outcome domain.
Very unique one too, as I guess you just pointed out, since you couldn't find that measure anywhere else. But I've never run across any other group that has a social capital measure.
Yeah, well, you know, it's one of our outcome domains at Watered Gardens, but we've found many nonprofits who understand the vital importance of building real relationships. And so we've created some tools that help you do it. We've got a mentoring tool called Life Deck that helps those relationships get established. But measuring how well you're doing in that arena is very important. And then the others are some of the things that, you know, you would think of naturally, like employment. That would be important, you know, housing. And for us, we talk about independent housing, because the government will tend to hand out housing like candy, but that doesn't necessarily solve a problem. And so we want to make sure people are working toward being self-sufficient and providing for their own shelter. And so there are a number of those kinds of outcome domains that are common among poverty-fighting nonprofits.
Who are the people who show up, not just to your shelters or your ministry in Joplin, but maybe in Huntsville and elsewhere? I think that's a question like people have out there when we see people at an intersection flying a sign, as you put it. And we're going to get to that. I want to ask you about that. But who are they? And generally speaking, are there types, distinguishable types or distinguishable journeys to that place?
We have an array of nonprofits, probably a third of our network. We have 94 organizations serving about 400,000 people across 22 states that are a part of our network. But a third of them are churches, and then two-thirds are nonprofits. And so it's a wide array.
Let's talk about then like homeless or sign flyers specifically. People really sort of on the far margins.
Basic things that I could say, like, everybody that over 22 years of doing this, I mean, people that are really struggling with that kind of chronic problem and on the streets, you know, holding a cardboard sign at a corner, there's a history that's usually very dark and harmful, as, you know, a lack of nurture as a child, a lot of neglect and abuse. That's just very common. You're going to find that 99% of the time. But the other thing that you find is, especially in these days, the last decade, we've just seen an increase in addiction and mental health problems. So it seems to be worsening. And so that's unfortunate, but I would say kind of a common thread for a lot of folks chronically homeless. You're going to find addiction and mental health issues are going to be a common feature among a lot of folks there. And again, that's really stemming from broken relationship. And the big problem today, Jeremy, is we're treating the symptoms, but we're not treating the pathology or the source of what's really going on. And it's causing more and more problems that you and I see in the news, that your listeners are seeing in the news on a daily basis, and some of the larger urban contexts. And it's like people scratch their heads. How can it be that we're seeing continued people on the streets and living in tents on sidewalks? And it's part of it's because we continue to treat symptoms rather than the pathology. And I like to give a kind of an example of that. If you think of diabetes as a diagnosis, which it is, and you think of the symptoms to diabetes, you can think of things like thirst, numbness, tingling, lethargy. Those are a few symptoms. Well, how do you treat those? Well, I suppose you could prescribe a medication for the numbness, tingling. You might tell somebody to drink more fluids. For the lethargy, you might say, well, just drink a good souped up chai latte, and that'll help with your lethargy. But the truth is that treating diabetes by its symptoms alone actually does nothing for the diagnosis and may, in fact, worsen it. But so we've learned to treat the source or the pathology, which is, you know, at the cellular level with insulin. So we know this. Well, now think about poverty as the diagnosis. Okay, so what are the symptoms? Well, I don't have any cash. I don't have a roof over my head, and I don't have any food. Okay, so we'll hand cash out at the corner when you're holding the sign. We'll put a roof over it. It's HUD housing can get you a house, right? We'll get your food stamps for the food, but that's just treating the symptoms. And we're not treating the source, which really deals in the relationship realm, broken relationships that have got to be restored or new ones be built. The broken relationships between a person and God, person and community, a person and himself, not having the right image of himself. And so that's all part of what leads to addiction and mental health issues. And so we've got to treat the source. Treating the symptoms only worsens the problem. And that's much of what we're seeing in America today.
Growing addiction, you say you've seen in the last 10 years, can be understood in part because of the flooding of the streets with cheap drugs, cheap opioids, fentanyl, things like that. But the growth in mental illness over the last 10 years strikes me as a more strange phenomenon. And we see it among young people in particular, not the ones on the streets necessarily, but you're seeing it with the populations that you work with as well. Like, what's, are there that many more relationships being broken in the last 10 years? I mean, what's, I'm struggling to understand what the cause could be.
Well, yeah. So I think deinstitutionalization is certainly a part of why we see a little bit more of it, you know, in missions and shelters and on the streets. But I think we've continued to see an interruption to the nuclear family from a number of different things. But, you know, our focus, of course, is where you have bureaucratic forms of charity that are stepping in to play the role of provider that decrease the demand for the healthy interdependencies that should be occurring within family and community. And so as a result of that, you don't have those healthy relationships and things begin to come apart. And I mean, that's such a general term, come apart. But I really do think that it leads to, you know, everything from feeling rejected and in school and not being able to keep up with others, and because family life is torn apart for one reason or another. And then you move from there into drug community, drug culture. And then I personally think that if you're going to put cause and effect together, I think it's drugs leading to mental health issues. My personal experience, and I'm not saying that from research, my own personal experience over the last two decades would say I've met a lot of people that seem like, hey, okay, we've got something to work with here, who got lost in drugs and then lost their minds.
So there's some things you can do now that go beyond symptoms, provide meaningful work, which was what you all, one of your key focuses, a relationship with God being another. But you can't go back and get people raised in their biological two-parent family. And yet that's the, if we're talking about root causes, one of the great prophylactics against people ending up in poverty. And yet I find many of human services organizations reluctant to talk about that. I don't know if you find the same thing as the ultimate sort of solution, insofar as there is one, to what we're talking about.
Well, are you talking about relationships in general? Or are you talking about?
I'm just talking about being raised by your biological parents, meaning you have something less than a 3% chance of ending up in poverty, if I'm remembering the statistics correctly.
Yeah.
Wasn't that something we all should be working toward as a policy objective if we want to get to at more than the symptoms like we're talking about here?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're exactly right. And, you know, a lot of our work is trying to help those folks who are past that point develop those new relationships and, you know, new life structure and direction and new hope, right, for a better future. But if we really want to get ahead of the problem, we're going to need to be thinking about the importance of education and, you know, with children. And we're going to need to be thinking about the importance of policy and how it impacts the health of the nuclear family. And we need to revere that institution. And I think that nationally, we're losing the interest in the importance of a nuclear family as God has intended it. So yeah, I think you're exactly right. But you know, let me say that it's not a, you know, that's where a lot of focus should be. But I think that like I'm thinking of a guy who came into our long term program. At one point, when he stepped into my office, he was probably 40 something years old. So he's way past that point. And he had actually gone through a horrific youth. He was abused both by his father and then later by his stepfather, witness to a murder when he was 13 years old in his own home. I mean, here he was on the streets, addicted. He's one of those guys that we've been talking about. And he comes in and he wants some help. And he says, it's our long-term program. We call it Forge. And he wants into our long-term program, Forge. And the problem is that you can only come into Forge if you are going to move on a path towards self-sufficiency and give up forms of public and private charitable support. And he, at that point, was dependent on what he called a package. He called it a government package. And so he really wrestled with that. And later on, Jeremy, it's kind of sad because he's one of millions of people, mind you. But he said it was the hardest decision he'd ever made in his life to give up that government package to enter our program. So there are a lot of people who are perversely incentivized away from those kinds of developmental programs that are going to be helpful. Well, John came into the program very thankfully and went on to be a, you know, where the state had thought of him as irreparably broken individual. He went on to have a full-time job as an over-the-road truck driver, independently housed with his own insurance. I mean, he made it. And he came back in a couple years after that, and he was just a transformed individual. And I said, John, what was it that made the difference? Was it our physical wellness? Was it our education? Was it the work readiness? I mean, what in our program, in your mind, made the most difference? And he said, you know, those things were helpful. The thing that really made the difference was the mentor that you connected me with. This was one businessman in the community who said, I'm going to meet with John once a week and develop a relationship that went on and lasted for much longer than a year. And he said, that's really what made the difference, was having someone that was my friend, who could help guide me like that. And so I think it's great for, you know, your listeners to understand that kind of relationship is so, so vital if we're going to help people that are on the streets that look like they have no hope. That's going to be a big part of the route out.
I totally believe that. And of course, that's something that demands more of us than just, you know, handing a little bit of money or food to someone, which is what makes it hard to do, but also it makes it valuable. If someone wanted to do that kind of thing, be a mentor, someone, how would you recommend they go about that?
Well, we have some training along those lines. So there's stuff that can be accessed at truecharity.us. You would be glad to help anybody learn some things that we've put together there, but I think at a heart level, Jeremy, you've got to want to be with someone who's struggling more than you just want to do something for someone. And I think that there's a difference there. And I think we've got a lot of people today who are kind of in that planning, the planners who want to do something to solve issues of poverty more than they actually want to be with people struggling in poverty. And we've got to get the scale tipped the other way, where we're just allowing that desire to rise, where we want to be with people and let's sit down and have a lunch together. Let's talk through some things. And, you know, again, like I've mentioned, Life Deck, that's a tool we've created that anybody can buy. It's lifedeck.us, and they can buy a Life Deck and get started. You know, I'm mentoring somebody right now going through life deck, and you know, it's easy to do, and you can just kind of walk through 40 weeks with an individual and go through various topics of conversation and be a friend. So that's so important. The other thing that's really important is to make sure that we view people in a way that we're not just handing things out. That's big. Exchange or reciprocity is a big part of that. I love this quote by, it's Adam Smith in Wealth of Nations. And he's talking about, at this point, he's talking about dogs with bones, but he says, no one has ever seen one animal signify to another animal through its cries and gestures, this is mine and that is yours. I'll give this for that. Now, that's a very simple observation, but it's profound in its implications, because that kind of exchange, or, you know, that happens in markets, it's a human thing. It's not something that animals do. And so anytime that we strip from another person his or her opportunity to give something or to do something for what he or she needs, we're stripping from him some aspect of his human dignity. So making sure that we get away from handouts, begin to really think about how do we enter into exchange with people, because they are people, then we're going to be much better off in helping people out of poverty. Today, dependency is a national epidemic. I think you've got 36.4 million people in poverty, 34.8 million of them are dependent on the government. And statistically, 70% of those, which I think is 24.6 million, are never going to escape that. That's a road to the end of your life being in dependent poverty. So we've got a lot of work to do. And I think relationship and valuing what a person is able to do for something that he or she needs is incredibly important.
James Whitford, that's very well put. And I thank you for sharing that with us today. Where can people find out more about what you all are doing, and how can they get involved?
Yeah. Well, truecharity.us is the website. And from there, you can learn about our annual conference and the tools and the training that we offer. And just be glad to serve any way that we can. But truecharity.us is the website to get to.
Organizations and individuals both can become members. Is that correct? Or is it just organizations?
No, sure. Yeah. Organizations or individuals. Right now, we have organizations, and we have a Friends of True Charity campaign that people, you know, give toward the initiative, and then they have access to some of the things that we offer to organizations. That might be a better fit for somebody, but again, all that can be found at truecharity.us.
Fantastic. Well, I highly recommend it. Thank you for the work you do, James Whitford, and best of luck to you.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's been great to talk with you today.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode. If you enjoyed it, we invite you to subscribe and or rate and review this discussion on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And have a guest you'd like to hear from? Send your request to our producer, Katie Janis, at kjanis@amfil.com. That's kjanus@amfil.com.